From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Sunny and dry Southern California is home to thousands of swimming pools and lush green lawns. But here are some surprising numbers. Since 1990, the population of the Los Angeles region's water district has grown by 4 million people. And in that time, water consumption hasn't increased at all. That's because the district got people to start using water more efficiently. Now the region faces a looming threat to its water supply: climate change. KQED's Rob Schmitz reports.
If you want to better understand how California's water supply will be affected by climate change, conduct this simple experiment. Get a paper cup, go to the fridge, and fill the cup with ice. Now poke a hole in the bottom of that cup. And wait. While you're waiting, think about the ice in that cup as winter snow in the Sierra Nevada mountain range. The Metropolitan Water District of Southern California has used this snow to supply more than 18 million people with water. Jeff Keitlinger is the district's general manager.
The great thing about snowpack is it's like a reservoir. It melts slowly, gradually as the weather heats up, and we can build our system and our canals and our pipes a smaller size and take that water as it melts.
Do you still have that cup of ice? Well, mine's starting to slowly drip from the hole in the bottom. Now, scientists say that if carbon dioxide emissions continue at their current rate, temperatures will rise and this snowpack throughout the Sierra will be reduced by 90% by the end of the century. Snow will become rain. And that dripping you just heard will sound more like this. This is the future the Water District's Keitlinger is preparing for.
Now, if you have this much more, sheet-type action where the water is just coming down and you have to move it and move it quickly, you have to have larger facilities, larger pipes, and you need more storage.
This type of future has prompted Southern California's largest water distributor to spend over $1 billion on a gigantic pipeline. It's called the Inland Feeder. At the foot of the San Bernardino Mountains, a huge concrete tunnel protrudes from a brown rock wall. It's hot and dusty. A group of us in hard hats, orange vests, and boots descends a flight of stairs.
I'm standing at the entrance to the western section of the Inland Feeder Tunnel. I'm about to get on a train that's going to take me 2.5 miles underneath the ground.
This train won't be here in a couple of years. That's because it won't be a tunnel anymore. It'll be a huge water pipe. Its large circumference, it's 12 feet high, will accommodate a lot of water. It's designed for a future of isolated storms upstream that'll dump much heavier volumes of water than today's storms. This 44-mile pipeline will carry water from the western Sierra down to a huge local reservoir. John Bidnarski is the project manager.
We'll be flowing at full capacity of 1,000 cubic feet per second of water, or the equivalent to filling an Olympic swimming pool in 2 seconds.
That'll triple the capacity of moving imported water to Southern California. Climate change expert and UC Santa Barbara professor Bob Wilkinson thinks projects like the Inland Feeder are good ideas in the face of climate change. But he points out Californians would also do well to focus on the water storage capacity we have underneath our feet.
The myth has been perpetuated that Southern California is a desert. There's no water in Southern California. It's all imported from somewhere else. And without that, everything would dry up and blow away.
In fact, half the water Southern California uses is local groundwater. That is water that's naturally stored in the aquifer, which is made up of water-permeable gravel, sand, or silt. The aquifer acts like a big sponge, absorbing rainwater and snowmelt from the surface. But LA has been drawing this water at a faster rate than the aquifer can naturally be replenished. To refill it, Wilkinson says, Los Angeles just has to conserve more water. He says that's what water officials should be concentrating on, not reservoirs or dams.
The largest new water supply for California will be coming from urban water use efficiency.
In other words, giving incentives for responsible landscaping and fixing leaky plumbing. Another incentive, says the district's Jeff Keitlinger, will soon be water bills that'll cost the same as cable television bills. A not too gentle reminder that climate change comes with a cost. For NPR News, I'm Rob Schmitz in Los Angeles.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. NASA scientists announced today that 2007 tied the record for the second hottest year in a century. A lot of that warm air was near the North Pole, so it's no coincidence that 2007 was also the worst year on record for melting sea ice in the Arctic. But air temperature is only part of the story, as NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Every winter, the Arctic Ocean freezes over with a bed of ice that stretches from Canada to Siberia. Every summer, a lot of that ice melts back, exposing open ocean. Melting sea ice doesn't change sea level, but it does change the environment for polar bears and other wildlife. And for the past decade, the meltback has been getting bigger and bigger. 2007 was a doozy, eclipsing all previous records. That trend has led Wiesław Maslowski at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey to make a bold projection. Soon, he says, virtually all the Arctic Ocean's ice will melt in the summer times.
If the trend that we've seen through 2007 continues, we probably don't need much more than 5 to 10 years to actually experience ice-free summers in the Arctic.
At a scientific meeting in San Francisco last month, he mentioned 2013 as the date that could happen. More warming leads to more open water. Water is darker than ice, so more sunlight gets absorbed, and that warming leads to more melting.
So we're just pretty much like a snowball going downhill.
But the Arctic Ocean isn't quite so tidy. Take last year's massive ice melt-off. Cecilia Bitz at the University of Washington says it wasn't just caused by warmer water melting more ice.
It's normally very cloudy in the Arctic, and it was much less cloudy. And that let in more sunlight, and that caused a lot more sea ice to melt.
And not only do icebergs melt, wind also blows them out of the Arctic Ocean.
We know there's this stream of ice moving out. Something like 10% of the ice leaves every year.
Last year, Bitt says odd weather patterns shoved a lot more ice out into the North Atlantic, and that also contributed significantly to the loss of Arctic ice.
2007 was fairly unique. You had all kinds of situations that came together to make it almost a perfect storm year for loss of sea ice.
Jim Maslonik from the University of Colorado says next year will almost certainly be not so dramatic, but the long-term trend is still worrisome. He has an article in the latest issue of Geophysical Research Letters looking at what happened to the Arctic ice as it melted.
The big change that we targeted was what's happening to the ice that's remained.
He and his colleagues found that the ice that manages to survive summer is getting thinner and thinner. There's a lot of variation, but in general, ice that used to be 10 feet thick is now just 6 feet thick.
So we have greater potential to lose more and more of the surviving ice because it's thinner to start with.
Eventually, Maslonik says the Arctic Ocean will probably end up looking like the ocean around Antarctica. The sea ice will form every winter and melt every summer. But because there are so many factors that contribute to ice loss, it's hard to project when that day will come. Cecilia Bitz and colleagues have run many sophisticated climate forecasts, and they show an open Arctic Ocean in the summertime as soon as 2040 and as late as sometime beyond 2100.
I will see changes in my lifetime that will be more and more remarkable, but I think it's the future generation that I worry very much for. I think that they will see a planet that we would not recognize in their lifetime.
That is, unless we do something dramatic, and soon, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Those emissions don't explain the dramatic year-to-year changes we've seen in the Arctic, she says, but they do seem to drive the long-term trend. Richard Harris, NPR News.
The standoff between anti-whaling activists and a Japanese whaling fleet is heating up on the Antarctic waters. Two anti-whaling activists jumped aboard a Japanese whaler called the Yushin Maru 2. So now the Japanese crew has agreed to halt its whaling trip temporarily while they wait for the Australian government to pick up the activists. The two protesters are members of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, an aggressive environmental group, which in the past has rammed and attempted to sink boats they believe to be violating international law. The Sea Shepherd says the two men from their group were assaulted and tied to the deck of the ship. The Japanese deny those allegations. The standoff has also affected another ship, a Greenpeace boat, the Esperanza, which has been following the whaling fleet's mothership, the Nishin Maru. The BBC's Jonah Fisher is on board the Esperanza. He's been there since December, and he joins us now to give his latest on the standoff. Thanks for joining us, Jonah. And what is the latest update?
Well, it appears as if like this standoff is probably coming to an end. The Australian government have said that they are going to intervene to get the two men from Sea Shepherd off the Japanese whaling ship and to get them transferred back onto the Steve Irwin. That's the name of the Sea Shepherd boat which they were originally on. It has seemed that there would be no resolution, as all attempts by the Japanese whalers to contact the Steve Irwin had been knocked back. The Steve Irwin and the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society had made it clear they weren't interested in striking any deal with the Japanese, and it seems only that the Australian coming in as a third party has enabled the two men to perhaps be released in the next 24 hours.
Let us backtrack. I will ask you a question, I'm sure with no easy answer, but is it legal for the Japanese to be whaling?
Hello?
Yes, yes. My question was, tell me about the legality. Is it legal for the Japanese to be whaling?
But it depends who you speak to, really. If you look at international whaling relegation regulations, then yes, they are allowed to whale because they whale under scientific research permits. Commercial whaling isn't allowed, but every year, pretty much since this ban's been in place, Japan has sent its fleet down to the Southern Ocean to conduct whaling. That's why they're going to be killing about 1,000 whales this season as part of that scientific research program. Critics, and there are many of them, say that it's a bit of a sham, that in fact that the whaling is more about providing whale meat for people to eat back in Japan, and in fact that the research they do doesn't really count for very much.
Yes, science in quotes. On the Greenpeace ship, what was the reaction to when these activists from the Sea Shepherd took the step of boarding the Japanese whaling ship? How did the Greenpeace people react to that?
Well, I think they were surprised and also quite impressed, really. The Greenpeace has been following a ship of its own up here and keeping a respectful distance, really, several miles back from the Nishin Maru. So when we saw on board this ship the footage of the Sea Shepherd protesters leaping on board the Japanese ship, I think people here were quite impressed. It's not a tactic which Greenpeace themselves do, but certainly the Sea Shepherd have succeeded in getting whaling into the news, getting people talking about the Japanese whaling fleet, and that's really what both of these organizations are trying to do, to make people aware of what Japan is doing here at the very southern end of the world.
What's been the public reaction to this, either from your public, who you're reporting to, or do you have any idea how the Japanese public is reacting to this?
Well, it's very hard to say from here. I'm,
yes.
I'm pretty much as far away from land as you can get it. But certainly there's been a fairly large reaction in the United Kingdom, where I primarily report to. People have been very interested and very sort of gripped almost by the story of all these ships congregating in such a remote part of the world. I think in Japan it's harder to say, really. The whaling story itself doesn't get a lot of play in the Japanese press generally, but certainly there are been reports that this incident and this confrontation, if you like, with Sea Shepherd has pushed it to the front of people's minds a bit more in Japan than it normally is.
And is there any chance the Japanese, because they were boarded or because of the attention from these two ships, will be calling off their trip entirely, or do they view it as more of a nuisance?
At the moment, they're talking about it being an interruption. Once the fleet gets back together, once the mothership, which Greenpeace is chasing, is reunited with the fleet, one would imagine that they will attempt to whale again. Certainly, the whaling season continues until April. And crucially, the Japanese fleet have the luxury that they have a large ship which comes down to Antarctic waters to refuel them. So they can stay pretty much as long as they like until April. The campaign ships have the disadvantage that they have to return to land. They can't afford to be refueled at sea, so they will have to return either to Australia or to South Africa in order to get more fuel, and obviously that will take a lot of time and allow the Japanese whaling fleet to carry out their activities on their own.
Thanks for your time, Jonah.
Jonah
Fisher is a journalist for the BBC on board the Greenpeace ship in the Southern Ocean. You can follow his trip by reading his blog, Jonah and the Whale Chasers. It's on the BBC website. I say we'll link to it. Coming up, we're going to, again, switch gears. We'll be talking to a group of children in Alaska who've become activists. They're protesting a planned mine there. Are they parroting adults, or are they truly activists, incensed by this mine? This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
California is creating refuges for marine life along its coast. It's an ambitious project, the largest of its kind in the United States, involving hundreds of square miles of coastal waters. Now comes the task of trying to prove that it works. David Gorn reports from the middle of Monterey Bay.
These waters off the central coast of California are the largest protected area for marine life in the nation, and outside of Australia's Great Barrier Reef, the world.
We're standing on China Point, which sticks out into Monterey Bay. It's close enough to the Pacific Ocean so that the waves wrap around and really smack it.
That's Stanford marine biologist Steve Palumbi. One-fourth of the California coastline, he says, the entire central coast area, makes up the first phase of the project. Now, the state isn't trying to protect the whole ocean here. Instead, it has picked out pockets of the richest marine life and restricted them from fishing. The idea is to set up little fish nurseries up and down the coast. In all, more than 200 square miles of ocean has been set aside. And that's just the start. California expects to expand the program in three additional phases to cover the entire California coast by 2011. That kind of protection, says Palumbi, is long overdue.
It's a relatively simple solution to what is otherwise a really horrific problem. That is, the health of the ocean and the health of the life in the ocean is something that is being stressed by all kinds of things, by pollution, by development, by global climate change, by overfishing. All of these things build up to the point where, in a lot of places, the ocean ecosystem has collapsed.
But here's the rub. To keep the project going, the state needs to prove the thing's working. It needs to see that there are actually more fish in the water because of these protected zones. But it's not so easy to catalog sea life in 200 square miles of open water. Fish move. The ocean is big. But still, the ultimate success of this project all comes down to counting fish. It's about 8 a.m. on a dark autumn morning on the University of California research vessel Paragon off the coast of Santa Cruz. Four crew members are getting ready to dive, their air tanks banging against the heavy gear. They pour hot water into their wetsuits to fight off the chill of changing.
Can you turn that air on, please?
Yep.
Divers go in teams of two, one halfway down and one near the bottom. They measure a water alleyway, 2 meters wide and 2 meters tall, 150 meters long, counting the fish, the invertebrates, and other life in that sample area, says boat captain Dave Benet.
The reef structure is really different. It's a really flat reef. There's these kind of long staircases, and there will be no fish or hardly any life, and then you'll hit one of these ledges, and it'll just be teeming.
These meticulous surveys take 3 to 5 months. They'll be done in the exact same spots every year to mark the ocean's progress. According to Mark Carr, the UC Santa Cruz biologist in charge of counting the fish, the state is hoping to follow the town of Monterey's lead. Years ago, Carr says, a small section of Monterey Bay was protected, and over time, its blush marine life has helped a larger area of Monterey Bay recover. On a tiny scale, says Carr, that's exactly the kind of success the state is hoping will happen all up and down the coastline of California.
There's no doubt that the MPA process in California is unprecedented. And certainly throughout the country, as well as internationally, everybody's looking at this process big time, big time.
In particular, officials in Oregon, Washington, and Massachusetts are watching how California is running its program and what kind of results it can produce. And the success or failure of this monumental landmark effort looks like it's going to be measured fish by fish, one dive at a time. For NPR News, I'm David Gorn.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Time now for Climate Connections, our series with National Geographic. Today, we visit two places facing the threat of flooding.
Around the world, global warming will increase the risk of catastrophic floods, especially in areas below sea level. That's bad news for one part of California near San Francisco. Floods there could not only destroy homes and farms, but could also endanger a major source of drinking water.
For ideas and inspiration, California is looking to the Dutch. More than half of the Netherlands lies below sea level. Its entire history has been shaped by the need for pumps, dikes, and other barriers to keep back the sea. NPR's Joe Palca visited California and the Netherlands, and he found that while the Dutch are taking pretty radical measures to manage flooding, Californians are still trying to figure out how to start.
California's water problems are largely focused in an area called the Sacramento Delta. It's a triangle of land just northeast of the San Francisco Bay Area. It's prone to flooding today, and climate change is just going to make things worse. There are many ways to protect the Delta and its residents, but deciding on one and actually doing something won't be easy. Part of the reason is that there are a lot of federal agencies with opinions.
The Corps of Engineers, Bureau of Reclamation, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, on and on and on and on.
Phil Eisenberg is a veteran California politician. He's tracked water issues for decades. Eisenberg says in addition to the federal agencies, there are comparable state agencies.
Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of water districts, of flood control districts, of irrigation districts. Add all those together. Any decision that gets taken in the Delta, in one sense or another, involves over 200 different government agencies.
Then you've got environmentalists, agribusiness, developers, and cities all at odds about what to do. Jeffrey Mount is a geologist at the University of California, Davis.
You also have this situation in California where we are a bunch of consensus wimps. And that is, we try to achieve consensus about most things that we do. And frankly, this is one of those problems where there's going to be winners and losers, and we're never going to come up with consensus in this.
Mount says building higher and higher walls to keep back the floodwaters won't work. It'll be ruinously expensive, and it's probably not the way to keep up with the sea level rise climate change is bringing. So, what to do? Mount says someone has to take charge and make tough decisions. And that's what he says is happening in the Netherlands. Consensus is dead. It's time for action.
They're actually cognizant of the fact that they are on a trajectory of change, and they're trying to adapt to that change rather than simply make it work for today. They're trying to make it work for tomorrow at the same time. We haven't got there yet.
Mount says the Dutch people and the Dutch government know there's no alternative.
If the dikes go here, then there's nowhere to go. So if you look at it dramatically, we're with our backs against the wall.
5,500 miles from the Delta, Eric Boezenkool sits in his office at the Dutch Water Ministry in The Hague. His agency is in charge of Holland's aggressive strategy to keep climate change from swamping the country. The Dutch know they have to work together when it comes to flooding. They have a 1,000-year history of maintaining the dikes to keep the water out. The Dutch federal government has concluded that it can no longer keep up with sea level rise by building higher dikes. So it's considering innovative alternatives, such as building barrier islands in the North Sea. And it's trying to reduce the pressure on the dikes by allowing controlled flooding in certain areas. But that means taking charge and telling people who live in those areas that they have to move.
Of course, it's difficult to come in and say, well, 30 years ago, we wanted you to live here to be a farmer. But now we want you to move out because we need the space to keep the system safe.
So I shouldn't think that it's just a question of walking down to the local farmer, knocking on the door and saying, sorry, we need to take your land back. And he goes, oh, fine, thank you. And just tell me how soon I have to move and I'll be happy to go for the good of my country.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't go like that, obviously.
No? I've been telling everybody that's how Holland is different from America. And now you're disabusing me of that.
Well, I'll try to put some nuance into that, maybe.
Nuance, sure. A kinder and gentler version of move. But basically, move is the bottom line, whether people are happy or not. There are flood control projects going on throughout the country now, and they're just the start. Pieter Derke is an executive with the water engineering firm Arcadis. As we stand by the water in the port city of Rotterdam, Derke says the Dutch are considering their options for the next several centuries.
Dealing with climatic changes, adapting to that, is a flexible process that will never end anymore. We will have to adapt again and again.
And for the Dutch, adapting isn't something to debate about. It's something to do. Now. Joe Palca, NPR News.
And at npr.org/climateconnections, you can see videos of climate science in action. They're from Public Television's Wild Chronicles.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Alex Cohen. In a few minutes, a video of a schoolgirl fight posted on YouTube as a warning. Bullies, beware.
First, another kind of fight, the one waged by Erin Brockovich. You remember her story became a Julia Roberts movie about a single mom who took on a multi-billion dollar company. The company was Pacific Gas and Electric, and the town, Hinckley, California.
Chemical contamination in the local water supply was linked to a plant operated by PG&E. The movie, Erin Brockovich, had a Hollywood ending, but in the real Hinckley, life does go on. From member station KPCC, Stephen Cuevas reports.
Julia Roberts' portrayal of the brassy legal clerk who uncovered the contamination and the cover-up won her an Oscar in 2001.
Internal PG&E documents, all about the contamination. The one that I like best says, yes, the water's poisonous, but it would be better for all involved if this matter was not discussed with the neighbors. It's to the Hinckley station from PG&E headquarters.
PG&E was forced to pay $333 million to dozens of Hinckley residents. The company is still struggling to contain the chromium-6 contamination. It recently bought more than a dozen properties to make way for the ongoing cleanup efforts. But now, residents say they have a new worry. An 80-acre open-air composting plant that aims to open up shop in a wind-blasted swath of desert just outside of town.
People here have seen this and say, hey, you know, haven't we had enough problems?
Hinckley resident Norman Diaz is leading the charge to block the project. He's organized town meetings, roadside protests, and even enlisted Erin Brockovich to lend her support to the town's new cause.
Why would you come and do this to us now? We already have our immune systems are compromised. Our water is compromised. Why would you think that this is a good place to site this? Of all the places to pick in this big giant desert, why pick Hinckley?
People are concerned about what might be in the compost. A waste management company called Nursery Products wants to take truckloads of municipal wastewater sludge or biosolids to the site. The raw sludge can carry dioxins, heavy metals, and whatever else someone might flush down a toilet. And yes, that means human excrement. The sludge will be mixed with lawn clippings and other green waste. The sludge is heat-treated to remove any harmful pathogens. The project already passed a lengthy environmental impact review. The owner of Nursery Products, Jeff Meberg, says his product is not only safe, it's good for you.
You could actually use it right in your backyard. You could use it in your potted plants. You could eat it. Just complete the cycle. I mean, that's how safe it is.
Little stands between the adobe-colored bungalows and mobile homes of Hinckley and the wide-open patch of desert that would be home to the biosolids plant. It's 8 miles from town, too close for residents like Dave Cheney.
My main concern is this stuff getting in the air, getting in swamp coolers, reactivating. It's not just human waste, it's everything that goes in a sewer. Can anybody on any one day ever tell me what's in the sewer?
There have been no scientifically demonstrated negative effects that are attributed to these compost operations.
David Cron is a waste management expert at the University of California, Riverside. He says there are hundreds of such facilities across the country turning raw wastewater sludge into compost.
Does that mean there are never any effects? Well, we just haven't been able to observe them. But certainly composting biosolids has received a huge amount of scientific attention by people all over the country and all over the world. And I think it's proven itself again and again and again and again.
That's not to say there are no problems associated with composting biosolid sludge. But David Cron says they tend to be benign nuisances like odor, dust, and flies, things chalked up to poor management practices. Hinckley residents opposed to the Nursery Products plant seized on the fact that the company was run out of another town over just those issues. Nursery Products owner Jeff Meberg admits there were problems, but he insists they won't happen in Hinckley. He says his company is not PG&E.
I absolutely feel compassion for those people because, yeah, they're going to lump the two projects together. And we've gone through facts point by point by point. They've said, we're not interested in working with you. We're interested in just not having you open.
But with the environmental impact review greenlighting the project, the plant probably will open. Opponents hope a lawsuit challenging the EIR will stall the project, but even they admit it's a long shot. For NPR, I'm Stephen Cuevas in Hinckley, California.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a solar sensing climate control system. Learn more at Acura.com.